Well, beloved listeners, you may remember that old friend of the program, the great Alan Bennett, in the role of an Anglican cleric, standing at a pulpit saying Esau was a hairy man. Well, on this occasion, we're concerned not about hairy men so much as hairy women. It's estimated that a woman in the United States can spend up to 25,000 smackers during her lifetime just on waxing body parts. And as a custom, as you all are to shave faces, underarms, legs, heads and other parts, just a few hundred years ago when the first pilgrims arrived on the shores of America, they were shocked at the strange obsession of indigenous people in preferring hair-free skin. Well, back then, a full beard reflected wisdom and intelligence, which is why to this very day I have affected one. It actually wasn't until the mid-20th century that body hair came to be seen as unhygienic, even filthy. And women began hair removal as pretty much the norm. My next guest, Rebecca Herzig, has traced the history of our efforts to remove hair back to the 16th century, with the more bizarre treatments to be found in the early 1900s. Well, I'll let you know about those a little later in the program, but they included velvet mittens made of sandpaper. Rebecca is Professor of Interdisciplinary Studies and Chair of the Program in Women and Gender Studies at Bates College in Maine. And she's the author of the splendidly entitled Plucked, A History of Hair Removal. A lot of study and quite a few programs here have been devoted to beauty practice, such as cosmetic surgery, breast enlargements, weight gain, etc. But not a lot of analysis on why we want to remove body hair. What got you interested in writing about this, Rebecca?
I think it's partly because there's been so little attention to it, and yet it's so widespread. I imagine that most of the people listening to this program either remove some hair from some part of their body in a regular way, or they're close to someone who does. So it's something we do all the time, something that technically we don't need to do to survive. And yet, it's something that we hardly ever think about. And
well,
as a cultural historian,
I do require a full body shave for many guests on this program. But you are too remote. You are too remote, and I cannot make the same demand.
And that is a shame. That is a shame. I would love to see that close up.
Yeah, and well, to endure it. Now, I understand it was the advent of the indoor bathrooms at home when blokes began to shave themselves, as opposed to being shaved in public at the barbers.
Yes, and then that movement also allowed for women and girls in their households to borrow their razors. It would have been a little bit embarrassing or stigmatizing for them to go out in public and purchase a safety razor when they first came onto the market. So they started the tradition that men would call razor napping, of taking their safety razors and using it themselves. And that's really when everyday hair removal started to take off.
It's quite popular at Guantanamo. You give an example at the start of your book about the forced shaving of Muslim men's beards and heads at Gitmo, regarded as abuse by them, and the ICRC. Authorities argued it did not constitute torture, but forcible hair removal has historically been used to degrade or control soldiers, captors, inmates, hasn't it?
Absolutely. Well, and if you think about it, having somebody take a razor to, say, your throat or your face when you don't want them to is a pretty dangerous activity. And so often when it's performed, forced hair removal, restraint chairs are used, kind of similar to the ones that are used for forced feeding, that hold the head absolutely still and hold the limbs absolutely still. And in the U.S., the military has strict protocols for how it's to be conducted, how many people have to be in the room, whether it has to be videotaped, that sort of thing, because it's so invasive. And we don't think of it as invasive in the same way we might, say, forced feeding or waterboarding. But the detainees at Guantanamo definitely experienced it and reported it as a form of torture.
I think one of the reasons I've always had a beard, or at least since shortly after puberty, is because I used to watch my grandfather with fascinated horror as he shaved with a cutthroat razor. He'd strop it first on and up and down, up and down. And then this yep. dangerous thing would be applied to the neck below that upturned chin. And heavens above, it was absolutely terrifying. And I used, would you believe, I had the same moment of horror when I tried to kill my stepfather. I had a very abusive stepfather, and he was shaving his neck, and I rushed into the bathroom and shoved him in the hope of effecting an instant decapitation. Didn't even nick him. So I've got history with the cutthroat razor.
I understand. Yeah. There's a famous story by Melville, the person who wrote Moby Dick, it's usually considered one of the best novels in American literature, but he has a lesser-known short story named Benito Cereno about an actual slave rebellion, where the pivotal scene is of the body servant, the enslaved man who's supposed to shave the ship's captain, taking the straight razor to his neck very, very slowly, agonizingly slowly. And as a reader, you get sort of that terror that you're talking about there. Is he going to slice his neck? When is he going to slice his neck? How is it going to go when he slices his neck? And yeah, so how amazing to be there close up like you were.
American Indians carefully plucked their beards and body hair, but the early settlers interpreted this as their hairlessness, their lack of being pappus or hirsute, as a sign of inherent feebleness.
Yes, and the early ethnographers and observers who were looking at Native peoples described it as a deficiency or a perversity, something about their inherent constitution that was weak or bad. And then early colonists made all kinds of arguments based on that Indians would never be able to govern themselves because they had these inherent racial inferiorities. So in that sense, the hair played a pretty important role in early ideas about who should be included in the new republic.
And during the 1840s, hair is microscopically studied and analyzed for racial distinctions in the same way that skulls were.
Yes. And as time went on, studied for other kinds of differences too, not just differences between the sexes, but also ideas about insanity or lunacy, ideas about sexual perversity or deviance, ideas about criminality. Criminals, their bodies were studied and the hairs were counted per square inch to see if maybe some kinds of criminals had more hair than others and if you could use hair as a predictor of criminality and that sort of thing. So it's marked a whole lot of different things over time.
I suddenly remember doing a program on the Merkin where, of course, pubic hair in its absence was replaced with that specialised wig. That takes it the other way.
Yes. And those turn out to be very, very old. There's evidence of Merkins in use in ancient Athens, and they go right up to the present. An American Apparel store in New York City had a kind of flurry of publicity, I guess, when they put visible Merkins on their mannequins in the store windows, and people were driving their cars up onto the sidewalks as they were looking at them as they went by. So long history.
I wonder if an anthropologist could demonstrate that the Scottish sporaners in some way relate to the Merkin.
It's a great question.
Now, we've established that the cutthroat razor is dangerous, and I understand the colonial American women avoided them and preferred sticky plasters made from shoemakers' waxes or tree resin.
Yes. Well, they were very familiar. Colonial women were making all the medicines and beauty products and other kinds of tinctures and things that people would be using in their homes. And so they're pretty familiar with all kinds of different plants and ingredients that now we've forgotten how to use or what they might do. But so they made all kinds of different depilatories for their use on themselves, on their family members in the household. They made them out of ashes from the kitchen fires. They made them out of ants' eggs. They made them out of acacia bushes, all kinds of different concoctions.
Cat's dung, frog's blood. One of the reasons I got you on the program is I want us to go into business together with a whole lot. Now, look, organic products, natural.
Yes, I think it's a great idea.
We will make a fortune out of vinegar and burnt leeches.
They never go out of style, burnt leeches, I think.
Advertising in the 19th century begins to undermine the confidence of women by saying a superfluous hair is the greatest blemish a woman might possess or the greatest disfigurement of female beauty. I guess one of the reasons for this is that while Michelangelo and other great marble sculptors could hint at hair, beards or pubic hair, they couldn't do body hair. So statues are perfectly hairless.
I think those ads undermined women's confidence in their appearances, but they also undermined their confidence that they knew how to treat themselves. So again, women had been making their own depilatories, but the ads started telling them that they should buy the exotic new compounds coming out from the Far East or the Middle East. They would call them Oriental treatments. And so women started going to stores. They started leaving the home and going to stores to purchase their beauty products, which was pretty new. And we think of the beauty industry as being really a 20th century phenomenon, but this was in the early 19th century that women slowly stopped making their own products for hair removal and started buying them. And as they did, of course, they started buying things that could be dangerous to them, even lethal to them. And a lot of those early depilatories turned out to cause really pretty serious harm to the people who bought them and used them.
I have a passion for Egyptology and quite a large collection. Uh-huh. Then none of my mummies have beards. The Egyptians had rendered their face clean and smooth, but then would wear a fake beard, a bit like a Merkin, a stylized beard. Do you, and of course, Egyptian women loved making up their eyes. They were very good at
that.
So there is a prehistory, in a sense.
Absolutely.
Of what we're discussing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's evidence that Egyptians had their own hair removers, often made out of resins. So what we would think of as sort of waxing, you catch the hair in the sticky bit and then you rip it off. Not very pleasant, but pretty effective. But it's interesting that 19th century is an interest in Egypt, bloomed in the early 19th century as colonization got started. Those early Egyptologists had their own fascination with hair, and this was something I had never seen reading that material, but they almost all have a passage in their books about the Turkish bath and what people would use to remove hair in the baths of the Middle East and in the Near East. So it was very fascinating to them, too.
I am required at this point to say this is Ellen Nell on RN Summer. And my guest is the author of Plucked, A History of Hair Removal, Rebecca Herzig. By the 1840s, as animal slaughter became centralized in the US, people moving in large numbers to the cities to participate in early forms of the assembly line, they had to find ways of removing animal hair quickly. Tell me what they did.
Well, people have been removing hair from animals for a very long time, too. Of course, tanning and leather making and meat production goes as far back as you can trace. But as that meat production was gathered together into centralized areas, Cincinnati was a big one in the United States, they found that one of the things slowing up the process, their ability to dismember a whole bunch of animals as rapidly as they wanted, was getting the hair off them. Slaughtering them wasn't the tough part, but dehiding them turned out to be hard. So a lot of people put new energy into figuring out faster and faster ways to do that, and they developed a lot of new chemicals that would do the job for them. And as those early industrial chemists started figuring out new chemical compounds, people started realizing that the same things could be used on women and started bottling up some of those compounds and selling them through department stores or mail order catalogs to consumers. And it worked. A whole new industry blossomed after that.
I'm sure I can mention Charles Darwin to you, although, of course, he's regarded as a blasphemous figure in much of your culture. But he gave hair a bad press in The Descent of Man, didn't he?
Yes. Well, I think it's a little known aspect about Darwin is how obsessed he was with body hair. And if you go through The Descent of Man, you'll see that he just talks about hair all the time. Eyelashes, eyebrows, hair on the body, hair on the face. It's a preoccupation for him. And it matters to him because, of course, the question is, why is man different from other animals? That's what he was trying to figure out in that book. And why do there appear to be differences between peoples, differences between men and women that he observed, differences between what he called different races, differences of all different kinds? Why are some people taller or shorter than others? And in the pivotal passage of that book where he says this must come back to sexual selection, he uses body hair as his kind of example. How did human beings end up less hairy than the other animals? That's the question he's trying to figure out. And hair removal becomes a big part of that story for him.
Rebecca, does he come to any conclusions as to why we are less hairy than our close friends, the apes, and why men tend to be hairier than women and Europeans hairier than Asians? Does he have an argument here?
Well, his argument, it's a little bit fuzzy if you look closely at it, but is that at some early stage in man's history, there must have been an unusually hairless person born, and an other early hominids, we would now call them, this isn't what he called them, other early men would find that hairless ape especially attractive and would breed with that ape, and then they would find those hairless offspring attractive and they would breed more rapidly and so on and so forth. And even at the time in the 19th century, as his Descent of Man came out, people thought, you know, this explanation has a few holes. And somebody wrote a full-length satire called The Fall of Man that talks, you know, explicitly about how silly this idea is. The first gorilla who, you know, accidentally ended up hairless and drew all these other suitors to her because she was, you know, hairless. So, I wouldn't say it was a well-developed theory, but he definitely had an idea that it was more aesthetically pleasing and that early apes figured that out and wanted to mate with the less hairy apes, and that's how we became hairless as
people. And of course, he also took long, lingering looks at a couple of very hairy women, Julia
yes.
Pastrana, known as the Bearded Lady,
yes.
and a 13-year-old girl from Vienna, with skin more like fur. Okay, let's move on to the medicalization of excessive hair growth and visible hair on women as a marker of ill health, Rebecca.
Mm-hmm. That's emerged really in the wake of Darwinism. People started taking up his ideas in popular culture, but also in expert cultures, and they thought, so how is this working, this evolutionary process? It coincided with the organization of the scientific professions that we're now pretty familiar with. Dermatology as a profession, psychiatry as a profession, anthropology, physical anthropology as a profession. And all of those different expert groups started thinking about this problem from their own kind of perspective, their own point of view. But taken together, they all started making the appearance of what they were calling excessive hair, more hair than they thought should be visible on a body, as a kind of pathology. And specifically, they were interested in excessive hair on female bodies, on women, and came up with a whole new category, a disease called hypertrichosis, excessive hairiness, that then was diagnosed in people for the first time in the late 19th century after the publication of The Descent of Man.
Lucian Freud and other modern painters make no secret of body hair. They tend to give it quite powerful emphasis. But if one thinks about the long history of nude paintings of women, certainly right through the Renaissance, it's invisible, isn't it? It just isn't there.
More or less. With some exceptions, there are some famous paintings and even a few sculptures of Mary Magdalene covered in hair as a sign of her religiosity and her devotion. But no, you're right. Other than that, it's pretty rare. William Blake has a famous image of Nebuchadnezzar crawling in the wilderness, you know, reduced to animality. But there, his being covered in hair really shows his lunacy. And so unless you're talking about really images of people in extremis, you know, in extreme religious fervor or extreme mental despair or distress. You don't find much hair. It's true.
I can remember observing a paradox in the 50s, and that was women shaving their eyebrows and then drawing them on. That all seemed to me singularly eccentric.
It'd be hard to find in the, you know, the volumes of things I found the most singularly eccentric case. In the U.S., we have a trend now, I'm not sure whether it's been picked up there in Sydney, but of women, especially young women, growing out their armpit hair and then dyeing it very bright artificial colors like neon pink or, you know, turquoise, and then posting pictures of it on social media. So there's always something new to try, I guess.
Well, better that than, say, thallium acetate. Tell us about that in the 20s. Because until I got your book, I didn't realize that thousands of women were killed or permanently maimed by this.
Yeah. So thallium acetate was one of the primary ingredients in a very popular depilatory called Kremlu, which was on the market for decades. And thallium acetate affected the body systemically and caused neurological damage throughout the body, tremors, loss of limb function, paralysis of different kinds, and then in some cases, death. And women had been observing these effects and complaining about them, but there wasn't a regulatory body established in the U.S. to govern these kinds of cosmetic or beauty treatments. And it really was, in a large part, the deaths from Kremlu and the maimings from Kremlu that led to the organization of our major regulatory body, the Food and Drug Administration, through the passage of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. So, you know, and it's pretty clear that there's still some gaps in the regulatory apparatuses that we have, because you can still have dangerous, even lethal products on the market that kind of slip through the net if they don't have to go through the drug approval process that prescription drugs do. You can get all kinds of kind of scary things being sold directly to consumers.
Rebecca, when I started doing this program 25 years ago, one of my first and most regular guests was Christopher Hitchens, and he was on and off the program until he died. And I vividly recall him having himself waterboarded, but I have you to thank for a photograph of him being manscaped. Christopher is having a sack, back, and crack waxing. And he says of it, the combined effect was like being tortured for information that you do not possess. What possessed Christopher?
That was part of a longer series. He was writing a very funny series, I think your listeners would enjoy it if they looked it up, on self-improvement and the kind of fascination with habits of self-improvement that people were taking on, and the waxing was part of that. But it is really curious to realize it was only separated by 4 months' time from his voluntary waterboarding, and yet he still, described it as this torturous process. And I think he was being tongue-in-cheek, but it really takes on a kind of different tone if you think about it in the context of Guantanamo and the fact that detainees there were actually describing their hair removal as torturous. Hitchens himself, so far as I know, never commented on that, and I sure wish I could ask him directly, but obviously we can't.
There's a point where it seems all young American women believed they needed to be totally smooth and hairless. And you describe an entire generation where pubic hair has effectively disappeared. And you point to pornography as an influence.
Yes. There have been big changes in the U.S., and I wish I knew more about the laws governing all this in Australia. But in the U.S., there were big changes in the 1960s about the regulation of what's here called obscene material. And in the kind of relaxation that happened after some of those changes, you got more and more graphic and more kind of directly full frontal pictures in popular pornography. And you can trace pretty clearly from that kind of changing practices of pubic grooming in the U.S. But the big changes have come with the rise of the internet, of course, which makes all those images more available to more people. But also the advent of new technologies and for dealing with hair. There's been the rise of laser hair removal.
Take a deep breath, because I want to end our chat by looking at those. But I want to tell the people that they're listening to Rebecca Herzig. We're discussing her book, Plucked. And this is the ABC, which is Australia's leading pubic broadcaster. Okay, lasers. Tell me about lasers. Yeah.
They really took off in the U.S., as in most of the rest of the world, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, because a lot of highly trained Soviet physicists suddenly found themselves without financial support. So as a lot of those people emigrated and had to put their skills to use, some of them started companies dedicated towards commercial applications of lasers. And medical applications were one, but of course medical applications have to be formally tested and then reimbursed in the U.S. through commercial insurers and so on. So they found that they had a more lucrative market in cosmetic applications, because those are just cash for services. You don't have to go through any third-party insurers and so on. And a lot of doctors found this a good way to make extra money on the side when they were slow getting Medicare or Medicaid payments back or something. They could just put a laser machine in their offices and offer some cosmetic laser hair removal as a side way to make income. So it's completely taken off. It's now not only the most popular medical cosmetic practice in the U.S., but it's more popular than all the other ones that you would think of immediately. Mm. Breast implants, nose reductions, liposuctions, more popular than the next several treatments combined. It's massive here, and it's growing in popularity all the time.
I'm only a part-time broadcaster. I'm a full-time farmer. And I'm very concerned about the encroachment of GM in agriculture. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the claim of GM is that it eliminates weeds. Now, clearly that doesn't really happen. But could GM offer the prospect of eliminating hair?
That's what some people are hoping for, at least. I interviewed a lot of the molecular biologists and investors and corporate executives and so on who are running small startups dedicating to finding molecular ways to switch off hair growth so that you wouldn't have to use waxes or creams or razors or lasers. You could just switch off the gene that grows hair in the first place wherever you wanted it to. Now, they've found the gene for hair growth. They have found ways to get into the cell to address those genes, to, you know, interrupt them, to stop them. But they haven't yet found a way to deliver it into the cell in a reliable way so that it doesn't go either in parts of the body you don't want it to go in or in a way that doesn't cause rather serious pain in its application. But people are working on this fairly feverishly, and I imagine that, you know, these things will come to market eventually.
Rebecca, thank you for a very spirited account of the history of making yourself less hairy. Rebecca's book is Plucked, A History of Hair Removal, and it's published now by New York University Press. Rebecca Herzig, thanks for coming on.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
You must not miss our next program. I'll teach you how to learn to handle the psychopaths at work, and you must know a few of them. And we also give you a history of tea drinking. Stick around now for the news on RN.